Hello, and welcome to Toklore. I'm Sarah.
Hey, Toklorists. I'm Kiki.
Join us as we discover how to save the world
through community and cannabis-infused folklore.
All while smoking marijuana. Did you ever watch The Adventures of Ichabod Crane and Mr. Toad?
Yes. I grew up watching that for Halloween.
No way! Me too! Can you imagine my surprise when I discovered it's based on a real Celtic psychopomp?
You know, a lot of Disney movies are like that.
And how?
On Toklore.
What are you smoking?
Today is Apple Mints. It's an indica strain. I'm smoking a cartridge today, and I'm liking how less stinky it makes me.
Yes. I mean, we have some skunky weed, too.
Yeah, we've had some days coming out of this place, and it's like,
we hotboxed the fuck out of the studio.
My jacket smelled like weed for a day afterwards, and it tends to clear out pretty easily, usually.
Yes, so yes,
it does. It's just a matter of walking out to my car is enough to
clear air out.
Yeah, nope.
I picked up some Jack Herrera flower from, and they're grown by Grown Rogue. They are grown by Grown Rogue.
That is a mouthful.
Yes, it is.
So this is June.
It's Pride Month. This is the month Pride Month, like Pride kicks off all over the nation.
Yeah, because I feel like it's different. Like the Pride parades or Pride celebrations happen at different times all over the country.
Yes.
Because Eugene has theirs in July?
August. Mm-hmm.
And I think Portland has one in June. I have to look them up. I can't remember. Eugene is hosting a Pride Month glam.
Mm-hmm. At the Big Dirty, starting at 8 p.m. on June 12th. I didn't put the date, but I know the date's June 12th.
Okay, June 12th. Cool. So right around when this episode airs.
Mm-hmm.
Right on. Well, yeah. If you have the chance to catch it or have had a chance to catch it, shoot us a message. Let us know what you think.
Mm-hmm.
I'm hoping to go this year. It's been a real struggle trying to get out of my comfort zone and go do social things out in the world.
Yes. It's hard.
It is. Peopling can be difficult.
Peopling is so hard.
All right. On to our topic for today.
Oh, what are we talking about today?
Doolahan.
The Doolahan.
The Doolahan.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise known as the Headless Horseman.
Yes. The original Headless Horseman. And I would say scarier. I think.
Yeah. I think the cartoon was terrifying as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
Endearing as an adult. And then when you hear what they're actually like, you're like, holy fuck, this is terrifying.
Yes.
Do we get to talk about what makes them a psychopomp first?
Ooh. So as a quick reminder, a psychopomp is a being, entity, whatever, god, goddess, whatever, that ferries souls to their locations in the afterlife. So it could be the underworld, it could be heaven, whatever.
Yeah. Nirvana, what have you.
Elysium. Yes. And this particular
Tartarus.
This particular psychopomp will they go on a roaming hunt, usually appearing around festivals, but most definitely at night. And they can only speak once during their entire journey throughout the night, and it's to call the person's name who's going to die, and that draws their soul to them, and then they disappear. And sometime later, that person dies.
So, in a sense, they're like a banshee.
Yes, they're related to banshees.
They are there to let you know that the end is nigh for someone.
Mm-hmm.
Be prepared.
Yes.
However, unlike Banshee, they're fucking horrifying.
Yes, they are very horrifying. I mean, a headless person is terrifying to begin with, but here, let's get into
describing what they look
like. So they're a headless person. It could be a man, it could be a woman, it could be a group of people, actually. A headless person who rides a headless horse or pulls a coachabower, which is a death coach or a coffin, like it carries a coffin in the back, and also pulled by headless horses. I think that's the part that's terrifying to me, is the headless horses.
But I've only heard of that being used in certain descriptions. That is not true. A common descriptor. That's one of those. It's come up in different tellings of this mythology, this folklore, because we also hear of it more like a nightmare where it breathes fire out of its nose.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yes. If it doesn't have a head, it doesn't have a nose, therefore it can't breathe fire. So there is definitely some discrepancies about the mount of the rider.
But the point is, it's not natural.
Yes. And typically the headless horseman keeps his head with him under his arm.
Yes, under his arm, in a pocket on the side of the horse somewhere.
Yeah, attached to the side of the horse.
And it's always rotting, and it's usually described as looking like moldy cheese. And that just grosses me out and makes me like cheese a lot less. And smelling like rotting cheese too. But they'll use their head and they'll hold it up really high to look far distances. So it's not like they can still use it somehow.
Yeah. They also have a whip.
Yes, they have a whip made out of a human spine, and they use it. If you ever look at them, they'll use their whip to whip out your eyes, either one eye or both eyes. Don't look at them.
So don't look at them when they come to take your spirit.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
This is just really, for something that's supposed to be in the balance, it has some real ominous overtones.
Oh, yes. But also this, like, there's a fear, but also death is something you avert your eyes to, which is
showing proper respect by, yeah.
So
I can see a lot of cultures having various types of turning one's back or looking away or covering something in a shroud.
Yeah, but averting your gaze at death. So, like, even that probably extends to your treatment of a dead body or a dying person, because you kind of don't really talk about it and you avert your gaze to it.
Is it more of a give them their piece of privacy?
Could be. That's, I don't know. I lean towards the other way because of how terrifying this particular
sure looks. You don't want to see, or maybe they make it sound terrifying to discourage you from looking. So maybe. This, which could also lend itself to why such outlandish descriptions that aren't always coherent
and they differ. But it is, so you can't really prevent them from coming because no gate or door keeps them out. Like, they just will burst open in front of the Dullahan.
They are
like
inevitable.
Magic. Yeah, you can't keep them out. But it's said that if you throw a gold coin or something gold in their path before they get there, it'll frighten them away somehow. Not sure. Probably made rich people feel very nice.
Gold, huh?
Gold, not steel, not iron, not silver.
I didn't see that one in the notes. Where did you hear that one at?
It was in a couple of the articles, and it was in Monstrum, I think, mentioned, and Myths Unleashed, something like that was mentioned in a couple of articles.
I'm just curious, because now I want to go look that one up.
Yep, I think it just makes rich people feel very good. Feel very immortal.
I do like Dr. Emily Zarka's. It was her video about the Dullahan that made me realize what a Dullahan was, and that the headless horseman wasn't just some silly story that they made a TV show about and a movie. Tim Burton did a movie about. Like,
yes,
for a long time, I was like, oh, this is just an American folk horror story.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, not. It's not even American. Its roots are Celtic, but it was an oral tradition, right?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I don't mean to get ahead of myself.
We'll get into it. We're still describing them.
But it is kind of cool how the story comes about.
Yeah. Another thing that happens is if you try to look into their carriage as they're passing, you'll get a basin of blood thrown in your face and blinding you, which just grosses me out.
Yeah.
It's gross.
Yeah.
They're just carrying around basins of blood. So we did mention this, how their whip is made out of a human spine, but it's mm-hmm. also said like the carriage wheels are made out of human thigh bones and the seats and cushions are made out of like human flesh. And just, yeah, different parts, or even all of the entire Kochabower is made out of human parts and flesh. It's really, yeah, it seems like a horror movie to me.
Mm-hmm.
They can trace him back to Cromdu, I think that's how you pronounce it, who is a Celtic fertility god. And the common practice to honor this particular fertility god was to behead their sacrifices, most of them being human. And this was nixed
way
when Christianity came. They also draw connections and similarities to the Wild Hunt and Valkyries, as far as like the ferocious,
the imagery.
Wild horse, mm-hmm. like riding a wild horse almost.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Wild Hunt also having a lot of roots in Norse and Celtic as well, and those particular cultures mixing a lot in Ireland. Especially.
Yeah. Well, especially through Ireland and Scotland, I think we see a lot of the stories start to have such similar, that the lines become blurred between, mm-hmm. well, what was their name exactly? Like
Slua?
No, I'm just saying that like the stories about different people like that have been passed down over time, sometimes it's just merely a difference of pronunciation that separates. Sometimes, you know, like there's just these small differences.
Yes, there are different names for Dullahan as well, but Dullahan is the most commonly used one and it's also the easiest to pronounce. So that's the one I went with.
Yes. And when you see the spelling of it, you don't always think Dullahan until you hear it. And mm-hmm. then you're like, oh, knowing that it's Gaelic makes that even easier to be like, yeah, okay.
Makes sense.
I couldn't spell it if you asked me to.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so the Dullahan also has a connection to this Scottish folktale of Ewan the Headless. He was a man who was decapitated on a battlefield during a clan battle. His name, the clan MacLean Lochbuie. Ewan
Lochbuie.
Yeah.
Is usually the name Lochbuie, mm-hmm. and probably a reference to the region where their clan was.
Yeah. So it's said that whenever someone dies from that clan, they feel Ewan's presence or hear his hooves approaching.
Of his horse.
Mm-hmm. And that's usually kind of the tip off. And a lot of this, like the stories that were mentioned in some of my research, that was the hearing the hoofbeats at a certain time of night. You're like, well, it's not mm-hmm. normal for people to be out at this time. It's probably a Dullahan. So I'm just going to avert my gaze and just hunker down until they pass. I mean, that seems wise. Like a tornado, kind of.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, it's good to be prepared for a tragedy when
mm-hmm.
you know it's coming. It's a little bit easier to at least lessen the blow best as you can.
Mm-hmm.
So
W.B. Yeats wrote about different Celtic folktales. He collected and then he wrote them down. And he mentions that in Norway, people are buried without their heads because it disrupts how their spirit passes. So, because in Norse society, the spirit or the soul has different parts, and different parts of that soul get passed on maybe to different people or go to different places. And so by removing their head, they disrupt part of that process.
Do you catch the reasoning behind why to disrupt it?
It's probably as a punishment or for an enemy.
Hmm. I wonder if it's anything like what we learned about the revenant.
Vampires, the Strigoi?
No, the Norse.
Draugr?
Draugr, yeah. Mm-hmm. Where they cut off their heads and buried them with them between their legs.
Yeah,
so
I
that
think
they couldn't come back from the dead.
I think there's a very strong relation. It might in fact be a little nod to Draugr's right there.
Or just the paranoia of they better really be dead.
Mm-hmm. You don't want them coming back.
We don't want them coming back.
Yeah.
You know what else I think is really fascinating? Just a side note, it's not, I mean, this is an auditory platform, but Yeats's brother, I believe it's Jack, is a painter.
Mm-hmm.
And he did a lot of expressionist paintings in the turn of the century. In Ireland. And he's got a couple really cool ones that are just all these different blues, whites, and greens. And there is sort of like the shadow of a horse that comes out of it. It's really eerie the way this expressionism. And he has a painting called Mab that he did that looks like a woman walking along the beach in a similar tone and color. Mm. And I just love the way the Yeats men and their creative understanding of their folklore, the way that they've been able to, through words and through painting, be able to share some really unique pieces of a culture and definitely a slowly dying out culture that was Catholic washed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They do give some beautiful insight as to the folklore of this culture that you don't really get when they're writing in a journal or a collection of someone else's stories as much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We'll have to post one of his paintings
on the feed
to go along with this one because it's just really cool. I'd love to see it in person. Expressionist paintings are just really fascinating to see in person because you can see each brush stroke.
Yeah.
Like, it's so easy to tell just how much work went into and like the balance of not overworking one area and how they were able to like fade the, I mean, the attention to detail while also like standing back and not being too deliberate.
Sarah likes painting. Can you tell?
I love to paint. I'm not good at it, but I love it, so I don't care.
Yeah. Whatever. Yeah. Maybe in the century, your paintings will be famous. Yeah. Who knows?
I don't paint enough.
So Sarah mentioned a lot about how they're mentioned the oral tradition of Celtic society. And it's true. They have a very heavy oral tradition, very stubborn to write things down. And when they did, they kind of they adopted the Roman alphabet, but kind of assigned their own pronunciation to it. But because of their heavy reliance on oral tradition, there's mentions of Dullahans didn't appear until the 19th century, until the early 19th century.
In writing.
Mm-hmm, in writing. And it was in these collections of stories that W.B. Yeats and Thomas Crofton Croker and Thomas Johnston Westrop collected from talking to people around the countryside, and then they just wrote them down.
So they are the Brothers Grimm of Ireland.
Yes. Yeah. So there's a specific reason why. Not just because of the heavy reliance on oral tradition, but there's a specific reason why it didn't appear until the 19th century. And it's because during this period, it was believed that peasants represented a lower, like a devolved human almost. And so it was believed that, you know, society was advancing so much, we're going to lose that. We shouldn't lose our human our human past. And so they believed that these peasants would reveal how mankind lived in centuries past. Which, I mean, to a degree, they were kind of on point.
I think it speaks to why it is when nowadays people think of folklore, they think fairy tales. Because a lot of our folklore was saved, at least in Western society, was saved by the retelling of these fairy tales and fables and stories that made up our past. Cool. So Sleepy Hollow was really where the Dullahan made their big debut on paper then. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah. Sorry. We kind of brushed over that.
We stepped to the edge and I just dove right over the edge.
Yeah. No, that's fine because I'm just totally skipping it. Yes. So Washington Irving is a writer who wrote a lot about the upper New York area of America, and he wrote Sleepy Hollow along with Rip Van Winkle and a couple of other stuff. He was in
upstate
New York, and he traveled extensively throughout Europe, and he had a family ancestry back to Celtic, and he had friends who were Scottish writers and poets. I think it was Francis Scott, actually, that he was friends with. And so it's obvious why he came up with Sleepy Hollow. Even though from a carriage, it's to a horse, and it's a Hessian instead of, there's a whole, story that Washington Irving gave it. So he gave it kind of a different spin. But, I mean, it kind of matches that area because there were some German settlers, a lot of German settlers in that area too. Mm-hmm. So kind of bridged those two cultures together in his story.
Well, and then a lot of that happened throughout the U.S. as it was colonized. Mm-hmm. We have all of these, I mean, lots of different cultures mashing with existing cultures, not as often as we'd like to see it happen. More the eradication of other cultures, unfortunately.
Yeah.
I'm really appreciating being this point in my life now where I'm understanding my people's and history's folklore. Like, I have so much like documentable Scotch, Irish, Welsh lineage. There's some mm-hmm. French and German in there as well, but a very large percentage of my genetics. And so it's kind of fun to be like, as we touch on some of the folklore and be like, oh, that's folklore mm-hmm. of my people.
Mm-hmm.
And something that I can be proud of. And then find ways and reason to be able to continue to give other peoples the same respect and space for being able to share their stories too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So now we've gotten to the part of the show where we put our creature into a taxonomy.
Taxonomy!
Oh, taxonomy. Before I forget though, have you ever seen Durrara?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I meant to put that on
there. There's a fucking Duolahan in Durrara.
It's Durrara.
Thank you. There's a lot of R's. There's a lot of R's in that word. Durrara.
Yes.
Nope, I can't do that.
I was going to actually take a minute to talk about different pop culture references.
Yeah.
Duolahans are making more and more appearances.
They are.
So I forget her name now, the character that is a Duolahan. You don't ever see her face because she's constantly riding around on a motorcycle with a motorcycle.
But she's also headless, so you never see her face.
But then you find out they make comment that she's a Duolahan, and she takes her helmet off and puts it on her hip, and she has no head. And it's mm-hmm. like, oh, literally a Duolahan,
yep.
But her headless horse is a motorcycle.
Yes, but I think this motorcycle transforms into a horse when she wants it to.
That would make sense.
I think so.
I haven't seen enough of the show to know, but it's an interesting show. Really kind of delves into sort of folk tales surrounding urban life in a province of Tokyo,
mm-hmm.
Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And so they do a lot of deep dives into some dark...
They talk about her history, too, in Ireland as well. Yeah. They get into it.
Oh, yeah. They're pretty straightforward about it as mm-hmm. well. In fact, part of why she is where she's at is because someone's stolen her head.
Mm-hmm.
And she's trying to get mm-hmm. it back.
Yeah.
I mean, that's one of the first things you learn about her when they reveal.
I like that she doesn't have a human spine whip, but she has this black... like shadowy stuff, like smoke that comes out of her neck hole, and she uses that.
Which black just, shadowy stuff that comes out of her
it
neck
seems,
hole.
I mean, it sounds very weird, but it seems natural in the anime just because it's anime. So it's like, oh, okay, this is, you accept it.
There's also a TV series called Sleepy Hollow that mm-hmm. was sort of a cop
really
procedural, like, but it was like taking the early days colonial America and mashing it up with contemporary present day America.
Yeah.
And it's really a very interesting and sometimes candid look at just how fucked up things are.
I like how there is a character named Washington Irving in the show.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah. I put it in my categories of TV shows with Grimm.
Yes. Yes. I think Grimm is better at it.
Grimm,
but...
Supernatural, Sleepy Hollow, mm-hmm. they're all in that sort of urban
yes.
mythology, dark fairy tale mm-hmm. fantasy.
Yeah. Putting it on urban streets, what would it look like?
I remember when I first discovered urban fantasy novels. I was in high school and I was like, what? They don't just happen in the middle ages or whatever, medieval mm. times?
Mm.
Fantasy can take place in my time period? What?
Anywhere.
It's like, how is such Anytime. A novel idea? Now I can't get enough. I do still love my high fantasy as well, but I do also enjoy a good mashup of high fantasy and urban fantasy.
Like House of Earth and Bone and
Yes.
That's a good series.
And Urban and Fantasy, Breath and Sky.
And High Fantasy.
Yeah,
mix.
It's the Crescent City Chronicles.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
No Dulahan there as of yet.
No Dulahan.
There's room.
There's a whole lot of other creatures.
Oh, yeah.
Which I find just fascinating. She does a really lovely job of having them all live in one giant metropolitan city.
It's a mystery, too. And when you get to the end, you never see it coming. Just by the way, you never see her endings coming.
Oh, have you read the second book
yet? I'm still upset.
So the way, after coming out of the second book, I realized I was listening to these walking home from work. And I had an aha moment about how her series is all about the stuff that Danica left for her. It's like Danica's love story to Bryce.
Mm-hmm.
And I genuinely am seeing this like bigger picture of how Danica...
Spoiler.
Whatever. So I do really love it. It's, yeah, total tangent.
Yep. Let's get back to our taxonomy.
Yes, back to taxonomy. I could just talk about books all day.
You could.
It's not podcast material. My apologies.
All right. So we've finally come to the part of the show where we taxonomize our creature of the month, I guess.
Yeah,
so the first one, as we all know, are they Occidental, Sub-Saharan, Amerindian, or Oriental? And I feel like it's pretty obvious.
Yeah, they're pretty very much Occidental.
Occidental.
Yeah, they're from the Northern European continent.
Are they beneficent or ambivalent? I feel like ambivalent.
I would say ambivalent. I don't think they care, because if they did, they probably wouldn't be quite so horrifying.
Probably wouldn't throw blood in your face, whip your eyes out. I don't know.
Terrifying.
So are they a deity, spirit, ancestor, or hero?
I think they're a spirit.
Sometimes I think they're ancestors.
But they'd be an ancestor
in the
reference of the Scottish story.
Oh, that's true.
But that's the only time that they're really like tying them to once we're a living being.
That's true. Okay, I think, I think spirit.
Yeah,
I agree. Societal, liminal, or shamanistic?
Societal. You should have put the descriptions on those again. I forget. Okay, help me remember this one. Okay,
so shamanistic is very much animism.
Nature.
Liminal is kind of a mix of both, and society is something
social
that
social mores, right?
Yeah,
or ways to explain
created out of the society to keep society running
structure.
The way it's copacetic.
Yeah, so one is structure, the other is a bit wilder and natural, and liminal is finding the balance.
Yeah, like hippie versus Christianity, a little bit right now, today. In this day and age.
Yeah.
That's what I would say.
I would say the difference between a Catholic and a Wiccan.
Yes.
If you're looking at it from a, like, form of a... But even both of those are very structured.
That's true.
But a lot of Wiccans celebrate and worship nature and the spirit world in that regard.
There's a lot more variety in Wicca than there is in Catholicism. I mean, you have different saints, but like in Wicca, you have anybody. You could be all performing like a spring equinox, right? But you could all be worshiping different gods and goddesses.
Mm-hmm.
And that's okay.
Yeah.
So I would say that this one is liminal, because I think they're still, because their connection to the Wild Hunt, I think there's still that shamanistic lean. But I think it's also very heavily societal.
I was going to say that definitely has that sort of like scare you into behaving a certain way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then we've got the four hard ones.
Rational, functional, structural, psychological.
So rational is the myth theory that myths were made to better understand natural events and forces that occurred in the lives of everyday people. Functional, myths were used to teach morality and social behavior. Structural, They show the two sides of the human mind, the good and the bad. They show the divided self and the duality of human nature. Psychological states how myths are based on human emotion and that they come from the human subconscious mind. So like how cultures all over the world will have similar fears and questions and wishes, which to them are unexplainable. So maybe this is more psychological.
I would say this is definitely psychological, because I think that man's fear, humanity's fear of death is definitely manifest in many types of cycle pumps. They're often feared, not because they need to be feared, but because they herald something that is fearful for them.
The unknown. It explains someone's sudden death who may one moment be healthy and die the next. Someone be like, well, you know, I heard a Dulahan the other night say their name, and that's why they're dead.
Yeah.
Could be.
Yeah.
So how is the Dulahan folklore, and what purpose does it serve the folk group? I think we've been touching on it this entire time, this shared fear of death and this forced aversion to it, like literal aversion. You have to look away. If you look at it, you'll get your eyes whipped out.
Well, and there's something too to be said for the imagery around it that really tells you when it started to crystallize as a form of oral tradition.
Mm-hmm.
Horses, carriages, things that were more commonly utilized. I would say Rome would have been the very beginnings of when we would have seen that, I think.
Maybe. There's no way to know.
Yes and no. I guess I haven't done the research for it, so then I'd have to really dig into finding out.
Fondue would be around the time of the Romans, because they didn't bring Catholicism over until much later.
Mm-hmm.
So...
But for it to be something that was perpetuated orally by the lower class, peasant class, there's also something to be said for the stories. The Irish stories were a thing perpetually being persecuted out of Ireland by the British.
That's true.
For centuries.
Yes.
Like they were not allowed to tell their stories or practice their cultural belief. I mean, even the way that Irish dancing is done today is influenced directly by British soldiers. And this trying to hide this beautiful aspect of what made them unique, that they were being prepared. I mean, the reason the Irish people were starving during the potato famine is because the potatoes were all that they were being left. The English were taking all of their food and leaving them with just the potatoes, and there was a blight that killed all their food. So they were starving, and it was preventable, which is why a lot of them left.
So what about the Dulahan myths?
I think that the reason it wasn't ever written down was because I could see theoretically it being something that was an oral tradition only. And so much about Irish culture, especially where you have to hide who you are, hide your language, your differentness from the English. And so something like the thundering hooves of an oncoming horse can be a terrifying thing if it's a British soldier.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not saying that these are directly related, but there's something to be said for paying attention to hearing bad omens and understanding and knowing how to respond to them. Don't look, hide, you know, avert your eyes. Like, this is, it's not you that's being called. This is how you pay your respects and you do it quietly.
I think there's also something to be said about the part of the myths where if you throw something gold in their path, they'll be frightened away or they'll just leave. Definitely denotes that there's supposed to be a reverence and a higher power that people who have money have over people who are poor. So they have some way of fending themselves, fending it off, whereas the peasants don't.
So even so much as having a story about how the wealthy can basically buy their way out of death,
perpetuates and the poor that have nothing. Rich people have power. Yeah.
And during the time that Britain oppressed Ireland, they made sure to keep them poor mm-hmm. so that they would have the power over keeping them subjugated.
I think, yeah, that's a very fascinating part of this, the folklore this month.
Lots of theoreticals mm-hmm. because there's a lot more to dive into. Yeah. I'm really curious to learn more, but I've always been interested to learn more about the ancient history of the Celts because so...
Still being uncovered.
Yeah, and it's another one of those old cultures that were wiped out by colonizing forces mm-hmm. that, and for such a long stretch of time, they have been trying to eradicate what's different or mm-hmm. their, you know, it's weird how we see these repeating themes in colonialism.
humans act similarly everywhere you go.
Yeah, there's always going to be someone who wants to oppress, and there will always be those who want to make sure that stories are preserved.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we covered it all.
Yes.
I think it's a good time to say goodnight. So we will see you next episode. Keep an eye out on our Instagram.
Yeah, see you next month mm-hmm. or sooner.
Or sooner. You know, you never know. Have a good night, everybody.
If you have your own taxonomy suggestions for this creature or any of our other creatures, please share.
Send us a message on Instagram at toklore.podcast.
Or send an email to toklorepod@gmail.com.
Please review us on Apple Podcasts.
And rate us on Spotify. It really does help.
If you have a suggestion, story, or correction,
we'd love to hear from you.
Until next time,
Tokes and peace. 'Cut out. We don't need to go down spoiler road. You haven't read the books. This will be where we stop. But I just have to point out that like every time something new is revealed about Danica that Bryce never knew about, in some way, on a big picture scale, was done in such a way that not just Bryce, but Bryce will have a chance, a fighting chance at a better future. Mm-hmm. And she did it at her own peril. Like she knew that there was mm-hmm. a really good chance that she would never see it, get to see it through, but it wasn't about her. Mm-hmm. And she knew that. And so she worked her ass off to set all the pieces in play before people found out what she was into, what she was doing, and removed her from the board. And so now all these things are slowly starting to come to light mm-hmm. that Danica specifically orchestrated toward, like, she may not have, like, been moving the pawns after death, but the woman cared about her friend and her friend and as a being, a human.
Also the world. She had this huge amount of empathy for the whole world.
Yeah. And I think that her relationship with Bryce is like the icon of that.
It's for that, her. It's like her that needle point on her compass.
Yes. Yeah. And so, and I think once Bryce fully comprehends that, she's going to stop being blinded by the pain of what Danica never told her mm-hmm. and start seeing the breadcrumbs that are being left for her.
Right. And but she couldn't have told Bryce. No, Bryce couldn't have kept her mouth shut to keep the same. To be fair, she actually is really good at keeping her mouth shut when she knows a secret. And that's all I'm going to say about that.
Yes. Yes. I really like Sarah J. Maas's novels in general because I'm just about done with the Throne of Glass series that she wrote.
Mm-hmm.
I'm putting off reading the last book.
I do that
I know
too.
It's the last book. I actually, and what's really fascinating is like the last two books that I read them back. I binged them back to back because they happen at the same time in different parts of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And then they all kind of, for the final book, come back together again, right? So I really needed to like binge those back to back. So everything that was happening parallel to one another was fresh in my memory.
Mm-hmm.
And stuff kept coming up from her novellas that she wrote that took place before the series begins, called The Assassin's Blade. And it's got like five stories or four different stories about the main character's life before her life begins down this path that she's now on. And it and they're beautifully written. They're really fun. They give you a really good, well-rounded look at the young, immature, haughty woman that she starts out as. She's a badass. She knows it. She has quite the attitude about it, and she can back it up. And I love that about her. But I also love that you see that, and then she grows. And every episode, every book, she goes through an ordeal, and she becomes a different person. And not that she's lost who this person was over here, but now there's this new
character development.
Exactly.
Like real tangible character
well-built, deliberate character development. And it turned her into kind of a fun, sassy character, into someone who you passionately love and are like, this person has fought so hard to get to where they're at. Anytime something... like when they are thrown up against yet another adversity, it's like, no, when can they get a break? Come on.
Yeah, but it's where they shine.
But then I started realizing that there's these parallels in these novellas that show the beginnings of the seeds that were planted in her life to train her and mentally prepare her for the trials that she's going to have thrown her way, that she's going to lose loved ones, that she's going to be betrayed, that she's going to have to come to terms with her past. And what she chooses to do with all of that information just turns her into a really interesting person. And I love that, like, by the end of the book, I'm on the final book of this series, there are so many major players that she has introduced over the last seven books. So there's a lot of different people to have investment into their lives because so many of them have been there from the beginning. Or were there in the beginning but were assholes that you didn't like, and then three books later something changes and you're like, oh my God, that's why they're an asshole. And suddenly they're this really cool ally you now have, you know, or whatever. So I do really love it. It's...
Goodbye, Toklerists.